great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and it's a Wednesday, and that means we talk about the wonderful world of wildlife. And today we're going to be talking about the pros and cons to living with urban wildlife. We'll take a look at those items with our guests today, David Drake. David, welcome back.
Thank you, Larry. Nice to be with you.
David, a professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison. He's also a UW Extension wildlife specialist. Jamie Knack back with us, too. Hi, Jamie.
Nice to see you, Larry.
Yeah, it's great to see you. She's a UW Extension senior wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. So we'll talk about urban wildlife. We'll also be talking about opportunities that you can take to enjoy the out-of-doors. We can talk about some early bird and bat migration. And I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments as we move along. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. And you can email us at ideas@wpr.org, or perhaps post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Well, you know, I'm thinking about the kinds of wildlife you can see in an urban area, and other than, I don't know, bobcats, I guess I've seen practically everything in an urban area.
Yeah, you know, we are rethinking what types of wildlife live in urban areas or where humans live, or we also refer to that as human-dominated landscapes, so you know, cities, suburbs, type of things like that. And, you know, we used to always think about it to be squirrels or an occasional raccoon, things like that. But, you know, we've got coyotes and red fox and hawks, and turkeys now are pretty common denizen in the cities. You know, sandhill cranes. If you go out west in Phoenix and Los Angeles, for example, within the city limits, they've got resident mountain lions out there and bobcats and all sorts of things. You go out into Alaska, you know, Anchorage, they've got moose in the city limits out there.
Yeah, walking through town.
Yeah. So I think, you know, we are really rethinking what types of wildlife are able to live in cities. And there's a lot broader range of wildlife that can live in cities than we ever have thought before. So, you know, as we've talked about in this program before, 85% of Americans live in urbanized areas or live in cities.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not like, you know, previous generations where people would mostly live outside of cities, or they would leave the city and go out into the country to recreate or kind of get out of the city and enjoy nature. People don't really leave the cities anymore, and the interaction between wildlife and humans is occurring in those cities, and most of those interactions are unwanted. People are not seeking them out at all. So, so what we are trying to do, Jamie and myself, is work on helping people understand why wildlife are in the cities, what types of wildlife are there, how you can keep yourself safe, although most wildlife interactions are not in an unsafe nature. So, but we want to make sure people keep themselves and their pets safe from bites or attacks or diseases and things of that nature. So we're spending a lot of time focusing on urban wildlife because that's where people are interacting with the wildlife species. And so we created a website last year called urbanwildlifeproject.wisc.edu, and that talks about what is considered urban, suburban areas, what types of wildlife might be there, and most importantly, how can you create or enhance or maintain wildlife habitat in your yard or your neighborhood and things like that. And some of the reasons you might want to do that is not only does it benefit native wildlife species and native plant species, but there have been a number of studies out there that demonstrate where you have trees or plants in your yard that would benefit wildlife, that it actually increases your property value. So if you want to sell your house for more money than you'd put some native wildlife in your yard. There's other sites out there that show that people have improved human health because they're out walking in these areas to enjoy the nice scenery, fresher air. It cuts down on the amount of heating and cooling costs you might have to do if you have shaded areas in your yard. And it also just beautifies your yard. So we've got a workshop coming up here in if you live in the Milwaukee area, or you can get yourself to Milwaukee on Saturday, September 15th. We're going to hold a four-hour workshop to help people understand how to create and enhance and maintain wildlife habitat or native habitat in their yard or their neighborhood or their community. And again, when we think about native habitat, some people think about, well, it looks unkempt or it looks like weeds and things like that. That's not the case of what we're talking about. We're talking about, you know, habitat with beautiful flowers or beautiful shrubs or trees or something like that that really enhances the look of your yard, but it is also extremely beneficial to wildlife. And so this workshop will be from 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. on Saturday, September 15th. At the Urban Ecology Center at the Riverside Park location, and this is in
conjunction. It's a pretty location.
It's gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous. So it's in conjunction with our Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, UW Extension, the Urban Ecology Center, and Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. So it costs $30, but we'd like to think that you're going to get $30 worth plus more out of this, and we'd really encourage you to come and partake in the workshop with us. We can accept up to 100 people, and I think we're going to put some information on your Facebook page, Larry, where people can find this, or you can go to the Urban Ecology Center website, or you can contact me at ddrake2@wisc.edu or 608-890-0445.
All right. So, well, there's a lot of information.
There's a lot of information.
Yeah, we'll get those repeated. I'm sure people are going to say, "What? Wait, what was that? I don't have a pencil in my hand." But we'll get that taken care of. But in the end, the end result, when somebody walks away from that, they will have the tools they need to improve, and they'll be able to ask. I assume they'll be able to ask. Their, all right. I've got this much area, and I've got whatever it is, and you'll be able to help them sort of customize perhaps their area.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think we're prepared with a lot of great resources that David's compiled, exist on the website as well.
We have.
And then also, for those of you that are thinking, well, I don't really want to attract more wildlife to my backyard. I have enough wildlife or critters I'm dealing with. I think David and I get that a lot. I just will put in the plug that typically there's maybe a dozen common species that get themselves into trouble in backyards. This workshop can help you with addressing those, learning the ecology of the animal and how to address those situations. But the big key point is there's a lot, hundreds of other wildlife that don't typically cause problems that you can be attracting to your backyard. And for those of you that feed birds, keep in mind that it's relatively few species of birds that visit feeders. But by simply adding some trees and shrubs that offer berries or fruits, you can increase the diversity of songbirds in your backyard. So that's what this really aims to do, is focus on those positive, mitigate some of the negative, and get more species diversity in your backyard.
It sounds wonderful. Well, we'll give that information out again as we move along during the show today. But let me invite you to join in with your questions. Maybe you have a question about urban wildlife and attracting it to your yard, or the other way, maybe moving it elsewhere, or maybe just have a question about wildlife in general. I hope you'll join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And if you've got some photos you want to share, some wildlife photos, we always love to see those as well. Let's go to the phones. Ron in Richfield Township, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Ron. Oh, we're not getting it, Ron. I think,
Hi, Larry. Good morning to you and to your guests.
Oh, good morning. What's on your mind?
Yes, elk were recently introduced to the Black River Falls area, and I think there's one up in northern Wisconsin that's been around for a long time, but this is just a recent one. And my question is, as far as like the introduction and the plans after that introduction, I've talked to folks, actually south of Fort McCoy, and the elk are starting to migrate out into the cropland, into the fields. And of course, elk are big critters, and it's like your cows or steers getting out into the field. And you know, as far as the management plan for these introductions, is there, do they address like when they start becoming problems in ag areas, and what are some of the, you know, some of the management maybe techniques? Because I think that's coming. I think they're, once they get a taste of soybeans and alfalfa and corn, they're going to be roaming out. And kind of what is the long-term plan for when, say, a big animal like that is introduced in an area.
Well, thanks for the call, Ron, and it's pretty timely in that this year represents the first hunt for elk in Wisconsin, but to specify that, it's in the Clam Lake herd. So the herd that was started in 1995 up near the Clam Lake area is the herd where we'll see a small number of tags authorized to kill just bulls. So the bulls breed breed multiple cows, so we can harvest some of those bulls, and the population is going to be comfortably over 200 animals in that particular herd. But the herd you called about is the Jackson herd, and that is not going to have a hunt this particular year. It's in a growing phase, and that herd was reintroduced to the Black River State Forest, and there certainly would be assessments done, a management plan done ahead of that reintroduction, and there would have been, or there is, a plan in terms of how they're going to deal with nuisance animals. And I know they've dealt with them in cranberry bogs. There's also some provisions for fencing, hazing those animals to get them back into the habitat that we want. In terms of the long-range plan, if you visited the Department of Natural Resources website and typed in elk management, you would that's where I would be going right now to look at what that current plan looks like and answer some of those questions. So it does exist. I'm not deeply familiar with it, but those would be items addressed in that management plan.
I'll just add really quick, so he was also asking a little bit about how to mitigate some of the damage, and I will say that elk are one of the species that are in the wildlife damage abatement and cost program as long as they're a hunted species. And so last year, that was the first payout to a farmer for elk damage to ag crops. And so that's one way that they can do that. So the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources will compensate economically farmers who might be suffering elk damage. They also will help mitigate in terms of management options like fencing or scare devices or something of that nature as well. And so, but keep in mind also that even though elk are large animals, there's not a lot of them in the state. And so you are going to perhaps have localized damage if they get into a farm field, but they're not going to do the kind of damage that deer are doing, for example, across the landscape, because there's just not that many elk out there. And so right now there is certainly some concern if you're a localized farmer and it's occurring to you on your property. Obviously that's unfortunate, but it's not a large landscape scale problem like deer damage to ag crops is across the state.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine, for example, the state of Wisconsin housing 10,000 elk.
Yeah,
right.
Oh, no.
It's just not going to happen.
Yeah, not feasible. Yeah.
Okay. Elk hunters would like that, but I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah.
No, I don't think so either. Ron, thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to Ellen in Waupun next. Hi, Ellen.
Hello. I'm calling in regard to a sparrowhawk that we have in the backyard. We have created a nice environment for birds in the natural with the trees and shrubs and flowers. But this sparrowhawk is just destroying the bird life in our backyard. And I know last year I called about it and they said, well, take your feeder down. So we took the feeder down. But he's back again this year. And I don't know that the feeder has much to do with that, because I didn't even fill the feeder for a whole month, and he's been destroying.
Well, Ellen, that is not an uncommon situation. And when you talk about sparrowhawks, we're talking about sharp-shinned hawks and or Cooper's hawks. Those are two smaller hawk species that are frequently in urban, suburban-type areas. They eat other birds, such as robins and doves and things of that nature. And as a friend and colleague of ours, Jason Succo, used to say, well, it is a bird feeder after all, right? So sparrowhawks, I know people are not happy that they're eating the feeder birds, but they also have to eat, and you are benefiting the overall wildlife community by allowing those birds to be there with some of the vegetation you're planting, but also the feeders. So taking down your feeder is one thing you could do. You could also try to put up some more cover where, or make sure that you're, if you have feeders available, that the feeders are close enough to cover that the birds who are on the feeders, when they see the hawk coming through, that they can quickly jump off the feeder and hop into some cover for protection. So some of those are some options for you to do. You know, those Coopers and Sharpshin hawks, they're going to be around. They're a very common hawk, and so there's not a lot you're going to be able to do to discourage them permanently. But one thing you might want to try to do is if you see them in the yard or in the area, when you see them out there, go and scare them out of the area. So you don't have to do much other than maybe, you know, spray a water hose at them or wave your arms and make a loud noise or bang pots and pans or just something to scare them out of the area. And if you do that consistently enough, they're going to be reluctant to come into your yard, even though they're still going to be in the neighborhood.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you so much for calling, Ellen. Good luck. Appreciate your call. Talking today with David Drake and Jamie Knack from the UW-Madison Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and UW Extension. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer today. Jill Nadeau, our producer, here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of wildlife here in Wisconsin today with our two guests, David Drake and Jamie Knack. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us today. Questions, you can email us at ideas@wpr.org or give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Colette in Three Lakes has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Colette.
Okay, I have problems with bears, except actually right this second. I'm wondering if you can tell me how to keep bears away. I live on the edge of the Nicolet National Forest, and I have this cabin, and we have lots of bird feeders around, and it is actually a mother bear and her cub, which stands about 2 feet high, is circling my clearing for my cabin, and I've turned on public radio really loud and bang pots. She's about 50 feet away in the woods. Any suggestions? I really hate, well, if I take my feeders down now, you know, she's still going to know that there were seeds there. So any suggestion, I have, other than, like, turning public radio, you know, when I had just, all my family just left, you know, I had, like, 12 people here, and we heard noises at night. But this is broad daylight, and she's hanging around. Should I be worried, or do you have any other suggestions?
So, Colette, you really do need to remove those feeders. That's the attractant. So wildlife come in contact with humans when there's a reward for doing so. So maybe to make this easier, give you some peace of mind, but our birds, as we mentioned earlier, relatively few utilize feeders to begin with. And the ones that do at this time of year, there's other natural foods available for them. So given habituating a bear versus the joy of feeding birds, I would remove your feeders and clean up any spilled seed that you have. And then some other things to just be mindful of is how you store your garbage at the cabin, making sure that that's secured, maybe in a garage somewhere where they can't get at it. And if you do feed any dogs or cats in the yard, making sure that you remove that food source as soon as they're done. You're not leaving that out. So really taking a look around the cabin if there's any potential food sources. Once you remove those, there just isn't really anything, any reason for them to be near the cabin.
Yeah, makes sense. Thanks, Colette. Good luck with that. Appreciate your call. Tom and Nina, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Tom.
Hi. We have some dead cottonwood trees in a county area adjacent to our home. I expect in the future somebody is going to want to take the dead trees down. Can you provide some guidance on why we should leave dead trees up to attract wildlife?
Sure. So first and foremost, safety has to play a factor in deciding whether those dead trees remain or need to be removed. So I imagine the owner, so that was town, you said, or city?
Yeah.
Those officials would need to be careful about, you know, protecting their own, you know, the risk there. So whether they have a urban forester come out and evaluate the tree, you know, if it's near a trail or an area where people frequent, that is a factor that plays in, is the safety. If that is not an issue or there's not a lot of users, then by and large, leaving that tree, you'll provide habitat for I think it's upwards of 70 different species of wildlife in Wisconsin that utilize dead trees at some point in the decaying process. So we also need dead trees of different diameters, and that's because raccoons will nest or will den in hollow trees. Some of the owl species will use tree cavities. And then some of the smaller birds like chickadees or even flying squirrels, they don't need necessarily a large diameter tree, but even some of the smaller trees like aspen or poplar can serve as denning sites or nesting sites for those species. But beyond that, it's also a place where insects congregate as that decaying process is going on, and you have woodpeckers and other wildlife eating, you know, using that as a food source. And then ultimately, when the tree falls, you still have an ongoing little niche environment for salamanders and additional insects and so on. So hugely valuable to wildlife. If you wanted a source to look at some information, there is a series called Wildlife in Your Land. And within that publication series, there's one called Critter Condos. And if you go to the Department of Natural Resources website and typed in Critter Condos, that would get you to that publication, and you can maybe use that as some leverage.
Good advice.
I'm just going to add one comment, if you don't mind, all the great information Jamie just gave. Tom, Jamie's absolutely right. Safety has to be paramount in this situation. But what we a lot of times recommend in urban areas is to have a certified arborist come out and measure the radius. If that tree falls down, that it could fall within a radius safely and not hit a road, property such as a fence or a car, couldn't endanger human life. And so leave as much of the standing dead tree as you possibly can, or that snag, but top it at whatever level you need to. So let's say, for example, that tree can safely fall within a 20-foot radius. So maybe you leave 18 feet standing, and then you take everything above 18 feet off that tree and do away with it. But that 18 feet of snag or dead tree is much, much better than 0 feet of snag or dead tree. So you might want to try to work with the city arborist and see if they would be amenable to leaving at least a portion of that dead tree standing.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. We had an email relating to geese that I wanted to bring up. Tim and Linda emailed about the debate about removing urban geese from parks. They don't know the answers to some of the questions that they've heard. If the birds are euthanized, can the meat from the geese be utilized at food pantries or by humans who are willing to take the meat? Does it depend on how they're euthanized? And then if the non-hunters claim they're willing to pick up the droppings in public parks, do you know of any cities where this has been successfully utilized in the past? I don't know of any myself.
Yeah, so the issues with Canada geese in urban areas typically is the aggressive nature of the geese when it's nesting season. So they'll charge at people for sure. There's issues, obviously, they eat a lot of grass, and what comes in has to go out, so that's all the droppings that you see. And there's some health concerns with the droppings. Not all of the health concerns are founded in science. There's some issues with E. coli in the water from the fecal load in the water, and some other issues about overgrazing vegetation and things like that. And there is an overpopulation of Canada geese in quite a few cities in the United States. So there are a number of non-lethal and lethal management programs going on to try to regulate or control the Canada goose population. I'm not aware of any city in the country where people are willing to go and rake up or clean up the fecal droppings. And in all honesty, that just would be such an inefficient thing to do because there's so much droppings anyway. So that is probably the last thing on the list of what I would recommend professionally in order to do to manage Canada geese. There's a lot of other non-lethal things if a community is interested in not killing the geese. There's a wide range of non-lethal management options that have variable success depending on what the option is in the situation at hand. In terms of lethal management, most of the lethal management occurs through CO2 euthanasia. So the goose is put into a carbon dioxide chamber. That chamber's charged with carbon dioxide. It cuts off the oxygen supply for the animal, and the animal within 30 seconds or so is euthanized very peacefully and humanely. And as a matter of fact, that is, according to the American Veterinary Medical Association's euthanasia guidelines, that is one of the approved humane euthanasia methods for Canada geese. And so, and most geese that are lethally removed from a community are contributed to the food bank and are used as a good source of local organic protein.
Oh, there we go. Thanks so much for that question. Let's take another phone call. Connie in Portage up next. Hi, Connie.
Hi, Larry. I have a question. I'm wondering why this year, I've been 12 years in this spot, and we have tons of Oreos. I usually use at least 12 jars of jelly. This year, I only used about 3 or 4, and there just aren't any Oreos anywhere. And I wondered if other people had noticed the decline this year.
We have gotten some phone calls on previous shows from people who had are seeing fewer, a smaller number of Oreos, but I don't know whether or not this translates to overall. Jamie, any?
Yeah, we'd have to look at survey data, I guess, and, you know, we don't necessarily do it on an annual basis for Orioles, but this really is a common question that we hear on radio, and that is, you know, what happened to the Blue Jays, or I'm not seeing any Wrens this year. And again, not saying that there isn't something going on, but we haven't heard of anything. And typically, for example, for me at my house, I'm probably going through some of your jars of grape jelly right now. So it can vary. So you may have, for example, other folks in the area that are feeding grape jelly or other food. There might be more natural foods available to them at this time of the year. Sometimes we see seasonal differences in the summer in terms of visitation rates for both hummingbirds and orioles as they're in different stages of rearing their young. So sometimes they'll switch over to insects or other food sources, depending on what dietary needs they have at that particular time. So again, I mean, it's definitely worth noting and keeping track of, but chances are if we talk to a few other people, they're seeing more Orioles.
Yeah. One thing you can do, and they will not reflect the data for this year yet, but you could go, if you just type into your internet search engine, breeding bird survey, and then you can find the transect that's closest to your location, and you should be able to look at data from last year and all the way back to, you know, some 60 years. And that will give you a trend data to show you how plentiful or how abundant Baltimore Orioles are or orchard Orioles have been in your general area. And then next year, you can actually go or sometime over the next few months, they'll probably report the data for this year. And you can then see the abundance of Orioles to see if, at least in your area, are they increasing, decreasing, holding the same, or whatever the case might be. But it's breeding bird survey is what you're looking for.
There we go. Thank you very much, Connie, for calling. Appreciate it. And Rita in Colfax, it's your turn. Hi, Rita.
Hi. I have a problem with a cardinal.
Okay.
He has decided that the windows on my home are things to peck on.
Mm-hmm.
And we have watched him fly from the woods around our house right directly to our bedroom window and start pecking on it. He starts about 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning. And he goes all day long, and he goes from window to window. My husband made metal out of a thin metal, made birds, and hung them outside the window, and he pecks below them and above them.
Hmm.
Any ideas how we can stop this bird?
There are some things that there's a netting, I think, that can be placed, but let's go to the experts.
So most
here.
Likely they're seeing, it's seen it's reflecting, it's reflection, and seeing it as a competing male in that territory. So it's coming to the windows because it's seen its reflection. So the solution to it is trying to break up that reflection. And certainly your husband was on the right track in terms of hanging a silhouette of a bird. I mean, honestly, you could just use a sheet and put a sheet over that window or a tarp or anything like that to just completely block the view of it. I know that isn't something you're going to want on the window permanently, but leaving it there for a few days might be enough to just encourage that individual, and you probably are dealing with an individual bird, and encourage it to move on. Other things we do to prevent window collisions in general, breaking up the silhouette by making sure we don't have a pass-through situation where we have windows lined up on one side of the house directly with the other side of the house and the birds are seen through it. Or making sure that we don't have reflection of vegetation in the window, that they see it as habitat that they're moving into. So I guess, you know, really coming down to just blocking that view. I mean, if you were to shut the drapes there or close the blinds, you're probably going to have the reflection. So it's something to do on the outside, and hopefully that will encourage this individual to go somewhere else in a short period of time.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like your husband is handy, and I you know, he could hang. There's some netting that you can see through pretty well that you can hang on the outside that stops it right away.
And if they haven't had the problem in the past, I do think it's an individual situation that maybe they don't have to go to that extreme. But the only caution with netting is you have to make sure that it's very taut, that the animal doesn't get or the bird doesn't get caught in it.
Yeah, there we go. There you go, Rita. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Carl in Greenfield, it's your turn now. Hi, Carl.
Hello. I have a question about mallard ducks in the swimming pool of the apartment complex I live in. What would they want to do with chlorinated water? I mean, they're having a regular party, noisy in the nighttime, in the daytime. They get mad when people and kids are in there. They're outside the fence squawking. What's the attraction?
The attraction is water. So ducks are generally, we call them as waterfowl. And so any body of water, be it a lake, pond, a swimming pool, they find that attractive because that water provides comfort to them, and they're, you know, comfortable floating around the water. They feel safe there. And they don't care if it's chlorinated or not because they're not drinking the water. Obviously, in a chlorinated pool, you're not going to have a food source for them. So they're there just resting, and it's kind of a place of refuge for them. They're not eating or feeding there. They'd go someplace else for that. So that's why they're there. And it's not an uncommon situation where, you know, we have plenty of reports where people are seeing mallards in particular, but other species of duck you might find in an urban area in pools simply because that water is there. So if you don't want them there, whenever you see them on the pool or in the pool area, scare them out of that area. So again, if you just go and wave your hands at them, yell at them, bang pots and pans, you know, spray a water jet out of a super soaker squirt gun or a hose, that should get them out of there. If the pool has a cover that you can pull across the top of the pool at night, I would do that. And you probably only have to do that for, you know, a week or two. And those birds were going to figure out another place to go because that's inaccessible to them now. Or if you have big floats such as, you know, rafts or tubes or something like that, if you can leave those floats in the water and take up as much surface area of that water as you possibly can, that will cut down on the amount of water that's available to the ducks, and they'll go someplace else.
All right. Thank you very much for calling, Carl. Appreciate it. And let's go to Ed in Manitowoc next. Hi, Ed.
Hello.
What have you got for us today?
I have a story about the sharp shin hawk. I've had that hawk come into our tree canopy in the backyard for, I'm guessing, 10 years. And now the fledglings, three fledglings, which are common every year, they just left, and now the bird feeder is getting active again with other birds. For all that time, and I've the first sighting of these, I noticed, I marked it down. February 27th is the first sighting. I had them come in, and they look for the same nest, and they use it, and that's it. But we have large trees, and we have a big under canopy that's open, and they just guide in and out of there. And they get, I noticed, killed, bird kill with morning doves and things like that, but the songbirds are not around much other than sparrows.
Yeah, that's a sounds like a wonderful place to be for a sharp-shinned hawk. And raptors, it's not uncommon they use the same nest year after year as long as that nest is productive and successful, because raptors invest a lot of time and energy into building these nests. It's usually built out of sticks and twigs and leaves and things like that. And if you look at something like an eagle's nest, you know, the size of just the sheer mass and size of that, it would require so much energy to build something like that new every single year. So that's why they keep coming back to the same nest. And obviously, you've got a really nice place there. So, and as Jamie mentioned, you know, year round, we put up bird feeders more for the benefit of us than we do for the birds. The birds certainly benefit from having food at the feeder because it's a quick, easy, nutritious, accessible meal. But the birds are going to be just fine if we don't put food up, and taking the feeders down, especially in the summertime when there's such an abundance of natural food available for birds, they don't necessarily have to come to the yard and feed, and just going to make it a little bit more difficult for the sharp-shin hawk to find meal, but they're also very adept at hunting.
Yeah. Thanks for calling in. Just to go along with the feeding business, Dwayne and Pepin emailed to say he knows people who feed suet in the summer. Wouldn't that be a bad substitute for caterpillars and food the birds would naturally eat? Plus, it gets rancid awfully fast in the summer.
Yeah, I typically suggest people don't feed suet in the summer. So in the summer, you know, most folks will feed the hummingbirds, orioles, maybe some Niger or thistle for the goldfinches, and a lot of times kind of leave it at that. So
put corn or peanuts or something like that out as well, possibly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Luke in Crandon, it is your turn. Hi, Luke. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, how are you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Must be bird day today. I'm not calling about too many birds. I'm calling about there are no crows up here anymore, up here in Forest County. And I do a lot of predator hunting, and at times I use a crow call, you know, as I'm calling. And since like last summer, but especially this year, I hunt old farms and even active farms because you'll find coyotes around cows and cattle and stuff. I was just out this morning, and I came back, and your show was on, and I ran a crow call for about 5 minutes, and not one crow showed up. And I had the same thing happen a couple of weeks ago up north at a big farm where it's got about 150 cows, zero crows. And normally you turn on a crow call, and you'll have 12, 15, 50 gobs of crows showing up. But even I notice the dead deer along the highways and stuff. You might see a crow on one once in a while, but I'm telling you, up here, there is something going on with crows.
All right.
Well and, you know, again, this I'm not concluding this, but the crows are one of the species that's susceptible to West Nile virus, the corvid family, so blue jays and crows. You know, the local wildlife biologists, it might be worth noting that with them, making that observation over the phone with them. Again, I haven't heard anything, but they are susceptible to West Nile virus. You're right, in terms of calling, you make crow calls, and they often come in mobs. So at this time of the year, I realize you're making this observation on a year-round basis, but even just at this time of the year, you may be seeing fewer because they're tending to nest and not being as vocal or drawing attention to where their nests are located. But yeah, other than that, I mean, we're certainly still seeing them, you know, where I live down here in the southern part, seeing them regularly.
David, wouldn't it be useful for him to go to that same website you were talking about earlier?
Yeah.
Repeat that.
The Breeding Bird Survey. So, yep, just Google Breeding Bird Survey Wisconsin, and then you can find the transect that's closest to your location or the interest area of interest for you. And you can look and see what crow abundance or, you know, the trend is. But the other issue, I mean, Jamie's absolutely correct. You know, we get all these calls all the time that say, well, I'm not seeing as much of this or that as I have in previous years. And there's a whole host of reasons. I mean, crows are a pretty far flying animal. And so they may be in the general area, but they might be concentrated in a different area that is not within your view. There could really be some population decline that might be caused by predation or disease or whatever the case might be. You know, we change our patterns and habits, and so sometimes we may do that and not really think about it, but just showing up, if you drive, commute to work a half an hour earlier or later than usual, that might be all it takes that you're missing those animals that you typically would see, you know, if you drove at the same time every morning, you know, that you, like you did 2 years ago. So there's a whole bunch of reasons that could be explaining why there might be fewer or more or whatever else the observation is.
And thanks a lot for calling, Luke. Appreciate it. David Drake and Jamie Knack, our guests from UW-Madison Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and UW Extension. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at the world of wildlife today here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, David Drake and Jamie Knack from UW-Madison Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and UW Extension. Lots of emails, lots of callers online, so we'll go back to the phones here. Christina in Glenwood up next. Christina, hi. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. First of all, a comment and then a question. Just to let you know, all those wonderful birds that you're talking about are here in my yard, and I have an abundance of them in such variety, and they all dart into my beautiful honeysuckle vines when if a sharp-shinned hawk comes around, and the hawk has tried but cannot get to them, and so doesn't even bother to stick around, so I rarely ever see a hawk either. And my question, yesterday I went to the Raptor Education Center in Anagul, Wisconsin, which is absolutely wonderful. And I learned that barn owls are in need of cavity-type nesting boxes, and I'm wondering if you can advise me where to get the appropriate plans for the appropriate size box.
All right. David, do you want to take that?
Yeah, Christina, that's a nice recognition of the Anagul Center up there. That is a neat area. For sure. So barn owls are not a very common owl at all in Wisconsin any longer, unfortunately. So even if you were to create a nesting area for this particular species of raptor or owl, I'm not sure that it would be terribly beneficial to begin with. I mean, you're welcome to try if you want to. And I would need to go back and look. I'm not even sure if barn owls use cavities. Did they say that they used nest boxes, Christina, in the program?
They mentioned that they do need cavity boxes.
Okay.
Because we are using metal barns now, so they're not able to access
okay.
those barns, yep. the wooden barns, to nest in cavity.
Okay, yeah. Well, I'm not familiar with barn owl-specific box designs or dimensions, but I'm guessing if you were to Google something, you probably could find something online and take a look there. And obviously, you can't believe everything you read on the internet, so make sure you're looking at a credible or reputable source when you look at that. But if you can't find something, if you cannot find something online, I would probably be comfortable recommending that you use dimensions for a barred owl or a great horned owl, and that probably would be suitable enough that would attract a barn owl if you are even lucky enough to do that.
Yeah.
And Christina, I can't think of anybody more educated on this than the Raptor Education Group there in Anagul. So going back and talking with Marge Gibson and asking specifically what people have had success in attracting barn owls, and the placement's going to be really key. I'm sure they'd be really happy to help you.
Yeah, that's
Marge
a good
on the show a couple of month and a half ago. It was a great show.
Yeah.
She's does some wonderful work there for sure.
But I will say also, if you do are successful enough to attract a barn owl, please send a picture.
Yeah.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, that definitely would. Thank you, Christina. Good luck. Appreciate your call. Well, Glenn in Middleton has something for us. Hi, Glenn.
Hi. Thanks very much for taking my call. First, I want to thank Dave and Jamie for being such good extension resources for people on all wildlife issues. And if they don't recognize my voice, I'll confess now I'm a colleague of theirs in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, and I listen to them every chance I get.
We knew it, Glenn, before you said hello.
So this is Glenn Stanos, and I'm the professor of tree and forest health. And I also wanted to thank them for bringing up the issue of the value of dead trees. It's something we teach in our silviculture class, the importance for all types of wildlife, but especially the idea that trees like this, either dying or dead, can pose risk. And I just wanted to point out that as a certified arborist myself, in addition to being a certified arborist from the International Society of Arboriculture, certified arborists can earn a qualification in tree risk assessment. And it's not easy. I had to study real, real hard in order to pass both the written and the practical exam and practice tree risk assessment. But if people are concerned about the potential risk of trees on golf courses or in their yards or in their parks, They should specifically look for a certified arborist with tree risk assessment qualification. And people in the International Society of Arboriculture will know what that is. They'll know whether they have that qualification or not. And it is really, really important because every year people are injured and killed by falling trees. And the process that certified arborists who are tree risk assessment qualified go through to assess risk of a tree is a pretty rigorous process, and it's well worth the time and effort, I think. So, again, thanks for mentioning that. You know, trees are dangerous, but they provide these tremendous values. Living cavity trees or dead trees, tremendously valuable.
Glenn, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call.
Thanks, Glenn.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. So with that, we'll move to another caller, Chris in Watertown, up next. Hi, Chris.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've dubbed this wonderful sandhill crane, who is wounded, foot cut off and partial leg, who has been visiting my neighbor's lawn and mine, eating food, birdseed, and would like to know, we want, it's been coming back and forth, still wild, wonderful wild. How can we feed this crane that comes back and forth to get it healthy, to keep it wild, and go south?
So, Chris, that's a really good question, and I can appreciate that you're likely very attached to the sandhill crane, and this is probably going to be hard to hear, but probably one of the best things you can do for that crane to ensure its successful flight south is to not feed it, is to not habituate that bird, that it stays longer or continues to stay here. So thinking about that a little bit, what I think you should do is continue to monitor that crane and see if it's exhibiting normal behavior. So you don't need to put food out for it, but it should be picking insects, maybe even catching frogs and things in the backyard, moving around, able to move throughout the habitat or that neighborhood. They can be fairly tame. We had them. I did a bird walk the other day right in on the university campus and had a pair of sandhills and their young walk within 30 yards of our group. So that's not uncommon, but if you were to approach it, it should flee. It should try to get away. It shouldn't let you get that close. And I would just monitor the animal and the animal's health. If you start to see that it's losing body mass or you're concerned about its welfare, then it's time to call a wildlife rehabilitator they're licensed in Wisconsin. They know how to take care of wild animals, to find the closest one to your area that would accept a sandhill crane or would be able to speak with you about it. On the DNR's website, if you typed in wildlife rehabilitation, you'd get to a directory and you could look that facility up. So you're welcome to call them for advice as well. But at this point, it's monitoring the animal. We wouldn't want to take it from the wild. At this point, it's very likely that animal will still be able to fly and to migrate.
The other thing I might mention quickly is you're not too far from Baraboo, and
yep.
I would contact, if you have any concerns or questions about what is normal sandhill crane behavior, also contact the International Crane Foundation. They should be a pretty good resource for you.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jeff in Eagle River emailed to ask about the issues with introducing moose back into northern Wisconsin's environment, wondering if that's possible. They frequently stray down from the UP and seem to do just fine.
Well,
there's some problems there.
Yeah, there
are some problems. I don't know that it'd be a species that the state would make the decision to introduce, because they are moving into the state on their own already. So we do see or get reports. I think of Oneida County as being one I hear quite often, the Minocqua Woodruff area, where moose are in the area. I believe there's been sightings of young, so the question of whether they're actually giving birth in the state. So there could be a couple dozen as we speak in the state. But there's not really any work being done to prevent them from coming, nor to encourage them to or stock their population.
Aren't there some disease issues that relate to this?
Yeah, Minnesota in particular is having an issue over there where they've had a pretty severe die-off of their moose population. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm not sure that they've actually been able to narrow down to what the specific disease issue is. But I know in the past, I think they've been looking at brain worm and some other disease type things like that. I think it's brain worm. There's I haven't heard of that disease or that die-off occurring outside of Minnesota, but certainly in Minnesota is definitely having a negative impact, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that would play in with moose, too, is that they're kind of on the edge of their southern range in Wisconsin to begin with. So to commit resources for stocking them with the potential for climate change impacts in the future, they're just probably not a very it's not a feasible species to reintroduce at this time. Yep.
Ken and Toma called to remind that UW Extension has a great publication on making nesting boxes. And I had thought about that when we were talking. I don't think there was a box for barn owls, but maybe there is.
I think there is for owls, and it's called Shelves, Houses, and Feeders for Birds and Squirrels or Mammals and Birds, something like that. So that is available on the UW Extension Learning Store website. But I can't recall offhand what specific owl species are provided.
Yeah. And bats. We've got bats that are getting ready to migrate, huh?
Yeah. So it's August 1st today. And bats, some of the early migratory bat species will start moving out of the state here beginning of this month and throughout August. And then obviously middle of August, some of our earliest migratory bird species will start moving south. So it still feels like summer, but fall is coming, unfortunately.
Right. And we'll talk about some other some bird migrations as well with our two guests, David Drake, professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and a UW Extension wildlife specialist, Jamie Knack, UW Extension senior wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. We are going to take a look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, but certainly encourage you to email in and also to call us, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll be back right after this look at the news. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here taking a look at the world of wildlife today with our two guests, Jamie Knack and David Drake from the UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and UW Extension. So great to have them along. If you have a question or a comment for them, maybe an experience to share, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org and post photos there, too, if you would like. We had Derek email us with a suggestion for the cardinal pecking on the window. He had that problem. He rubbed ivory soap bar on the windows to make them opaque. It washes off as summer goes on, and it worked for him. And then Peggy in Mondovi suggests using Post-it notes. That's what she did on her window, and that worked as well.
I think those are great great suggestions. One, they're temporary, so they can easily be removed. And two, they're not very costly. So yeah. Those are great suggestions to try.
The other thing, too, if you have screens on the outside of your windows, a lot of time that screen material will break up the reflection, and it provides a barrier for the bird actually to get to the window, the glass itself. So that's something else to think about.
Yeah, Fox and Krivitz, he says, a Mylar Christmas garland hung from the window frame inside the house stopped birds from flying into his windows.
Yep, compact CDs. If anybody still has any of those around, those work well, or the aluminum pie plate, anything to break it up. But
yeah, there we go. Well, let's go to the phones. And John in Renee Island State Park. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry. I actually live up at Baudette, Minnesota. You know where that is?
Yeah, that's a ways up
country. The moose in Minnesota are in trouble. The articles we see in the paper, climate change is driving the range north. And so they're finding, and it's stressing the moose in not providing the climate they need, and it's also increasing the tick population. Yeah. The biggest problem they're finding are a lot of calves that just are carrying too many ticks to support their lifestyle.
Yeah.
So that's part. And in western Minnesota, from where we are west, they're almost calling the moose extinct. They've
wow.
gone from a few thousand to a few hundred.
Yeah, that's too bad.
And we've seen one since we've been there.
Wow.
But in northeast, there's a few, but they're concerned. This was the first year they saw a stable population in their winter surveys.
Well, that's good information, John. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call, and it just kind of goes to show, you know, for moose to be in Wisconsin actually
yeah.
having a large population, it probably just ain't going to happen.
Yeah, yet. Probably not viable.
Yeah, unfortunately, because they are quite the animal.
Thanks a lot for calling with that info. Appreciate it, John. Let's go to Brad in Osseo next. Brad, hello to you.
Hi, Larry, and your guests. Thank you for having me on. I've got a question about bats. This year I've noticed on my farm property here that I don't have any bats flying in the evening, you know, at night at all. I haven't seen any, and I had, I've always had every summer some of them habitating my barn, and they're not around. And I'm wondering if there's been any advancement in treatment of that white nose syndrome or what could possibly be causing them to not be here this year.
Yeah,
Brad, that's a good question. And again, this is another kind of sobering, unfortunate wildlife story, you know, similar to the moose. So the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has done a phenomenal job of being vigilant about white nose syndrome. It's that fungus that is showing up in bat caves and hibernacula and mines and things like that. So the four of the eight bat species we have in the state of Wisconsin, the four that are resident bat species, those are the ones who hibernate over the wintertime, stay here year-round, hibernate. And those are the four species that are susceptible to white nose syndrome. And so the DNR has been going into known caves and mines in the wintertime to monitor white nose syndrome and bat populations. And unfortunately, the first cave that they found white nose syndrome in, maybe 4 or 5 years ago down in Grant County, I think they've seen a 90% reduction of the bat population in that particular cave. And so with each subsequent year that white nose syndrome is in the state of Wisconsin, it seems that it has a more profound negative effect on the bat population. And so the DNR, one of their conclusions is that they're not seeing as many bats at the summer roosts simply because some of the bats are starting to die of white nose syndrome during the wintertime during hibernation. So that might be one of the explanations that is going on to explain why you're not seeing bats in your area. Again, you know, as we've talked about with some other species we've mentioned in this program so far, it could just simply be that, you know, bats are insectivores. They're very mobile species. They may be moving to where there's a more concentrated food source that's out of your area. And so there might be the same number of bats. They're just not in your area, but they're someplace else. It could be that you're just not observing them because you're out. Your patterns of behavior have changed, or your activity patterns have changed some way. So there's a variety of explanations, and there's no definitive explanation yet to explain why you might be seeing fewer bats. But certainly white nose syndrome, unfortunately, is one of the variables that people are starting to look at.
You know, there's some research going
yeah.
on, isn't there, to kind of attack
yeah,
white nose syndrome
yep.
in caves?
Yeah, thanks for the remembrance of that. That was Brad's second question. Yeah, so there is a feverish amount of research going on to try to figure out how to reduce or eliminate white nose syndrome. And so some of the research involves people at the University of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, the United States Geological Survey at the Wildlife Health Lab here in Madison, and they're actually trying to develop a vaccine. And so they are making some strides, still in the laboratory phase, so they haven't been able to move it out of the lab into the wild yet. Other people are looking at different types of soil bacterium to try to figure out naturally occurring soil bacterium that might be able to be spread within these cave systems to combat the fungus that's creating white nose syndrome. The problem is these cave ecosystems are so fragile, And if you start, as Otto Leopold says, you start pulling on the thread a little bit, and you're never sure what you're going to unravel, and you may actually be creating a greater problem trying to eradicate the fungus in the cave, in the overall cave ecosystem, if you're not quite sure about all of the direct and indirect effects of your management actions. So people are treading lightly simply for that reason, but they're also trying to figure out what is the best way to attack this insidious disease.
Wow. Thanks for calling, Brad. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Give a call. Let's go to Michelle in Coon Valley next. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. Hi, I have a couple comments. So the woman that was calling about the lack of Orioles, I think they're all in my backyard. I went through a record of 23. I went through 23 jars of grape jelly so far this year, and at least three nests are on my house. So that's a positive thing.
Yeah.
And then the other thing I was wanted to state, too, is the man who called about the lack of crows. And, you know, I've kind of noticed a lot of crows around as well, and seen some just dead on the side of the road, which is kind of unusual. And I know we're about 15 miles outside of La Crosse, and I'm just wondering about West Nile virus, if that's kind of thinning some of the populations around this area.
Sure.
Yeah, it's possible. I don't know that we have that direct. We know that West Nile virus affects corvids and affects crows, but whether it's having a population effect, I don't believe we know that answer. So as David mentioned, that trend or a declining trend, we would likely first detect that in terms of a science-based approach through the breeding bird survey. And as far as seeing crows dead on the road, that's not actually that uncommon because they scavenge and eat carrion, so deer, raccoons, whatever, on the road. So it wouldn't be unheard of for them to be hit by a car and to be in that location. So, yeah, it's one of those things we're just going to have to wait and kind of see how it plays out. I mean, you're always welcome to call the local biologist in your area and see if others have reported that to see if there's a trend. You could also go and look at the CDC website and see what reports have been in your area for West Nile virus and, you mm-hmm. know, the species document that it's been confirmed in for this year and previous years.
And Michelle, we have Marilyn in Montford in southwest Wisconsin who might be able to one-up you on the on the Baltimore Orioles. She says she feeds jelly all summer long and gets Orioles young and mature. She goes through a pound of jelly a day.
Wow.
That's a lot.
Wow. That's a lot of money, too.
That's a lot. Well, fortunately, grape jelly is probably the cheapest jelly you can buy.
Yeah, and you can get the off-brand, so it's not too bad, but still.
There you go. Michelle, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Let's turn to Steve in Iola next. Hi, Steve.
Hello. I have noticed that the sandhill cranes in my area, hardly any of them have any chicks this year. And I also noticed that the turkey poults seem to be pretty scarce this year, and I was wondering if that big late snow we had anything to do with it.
And Steve, again, we won't quite know that until the surveys play out through the course of the year. You know, sandhill crane chicks are fairly good size now. It can be difficult. The three that I saw with this group I was birding with in Madison, it was pretty difficult to tell the juvenile from the two adults unless you had the binoculars to really look at the coloring. So they're getting to be good size. And turkeys, too, at this time of the year, we have such lush, thick vegetation. It's really difficult unless they're right at the road ditch to the point that you even see them unless they're foraging in a field. So I've noticed a few, but this time of year, it's pretty, you know, there's a lot of vegetation to hide them and conceal them in as well. So I guess we'll just, you know, kind of have to wait and see. But you are absolutely correct that the spring rain, cold temperatures can have an effect on some of those ground nesting birds.
Yeah, I do a little turkey hunting in the Brooklyn area of Wisconsin, and the farmer I met with or talked to him over the weekend, he said, oh, he's got lots of turkeys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we've had several callers over the last many months say that they are seeing fewer turkeys.
Yeah. Well, and with the, you know, the weather in the state varies so much locally, too. So you might see a local decline, and that bears out in the survey work that's done.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of predators, too, and especially turkey nests. So if you have a boost in the raccoon population or the skunk population, or snakes or whatever the case might be, you know, they may be taking more eggs out of the nest this year than they have in past years, and that might explain it as well. But I don't think that certainly the turkey population statewide is in any danger of declining anytime soon.
Mark emailed some photos and wonders if he's got a photo of some coyotes in their nest, and it's a pretty cool photo.
Yeah, that is a den. I don't know exactly the location, but they do look like coyotes from what we can see of the adult behind. It looks like maybe two or three pups. So,
yeah.
And David would certainly have experience seeing coyote
awesome.
And fox.
That is really
that
cool.
Close, so.
That is really
cool.
Yeah,
very cool.
So I wonder if you got it on a game camera or with a, you know, a regular point and shoot camera or a phone camera.
Well, Mark
didn't say, huh?
Mark didn't say, but maybe he'll email back and let us know how he got those photos.
Yeah.
Mark, do that if you have a minute.
And the as specific a location as you're comfortable giving us, that would also be fun to know.
All right, there we go. David in St. Croix County, on to you now. Hi, David.
I say, I just kind of wanted to reinforce that last caller, or not maybe the last caller, but the one caller about the sandhill chick cranes and not seeing much for them. I think there is a huge problem with predators in our state. We have the only pair of nesting whooping cranes west of the Baraboo group, and for 3 years in a row now, they've lost either their eggs or their chick has only survived a day or two, and they're literally right in my backyard, and it's all predator. They're being taken by fox and raccoons, and because of, you know, there's nothing for a fur market. I'm not going to get into that political thing one way or another, but there's really not much of a control on the predator base right now, and I think it's having a huge effect on the bird species out there.
Yeah,
it could be. You know, the other issue that they've had, they've really struggled to have whooping crane production here in the Wisconsin area, and a lot of it has been due to black flies, too, that the black flies are just driving the crane parents off the nest, or they're attacking, you know, the chicks after they get hatched out. And so, you know, who knows, until you get more data, who knows specifically what's causing the you know, crane in your area, for those crane chicks not to survive, but it could be a variety of issues.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly here. The Wisconsin DNR has a couple of opportunities to explore outdoor skills.
Yeah,
are you familiar
this Saturday? If you don't have plans, Horicon Marsh on Saturday from 9:30 to 12:30, they're going to have a number of outdoor activities, anywhere from watching hunting dogs or trialing dogs. So versatile dogs do what they do. So dog demonstrations, an opportunity to try archery, work on perfecting your casting for fishing. Also, how to use binoculars, maybe do some bird watching. I think there's going to be a scavenger hunt activity. And try your hand at goose or duck calling or turkey calling for the upcoming spring. So lots of opportunities there at Horicon.
That's free.
Free event, very family-oriented. And also, Crex Meadows Wildlife Management Area is having various outdoor skills events for the entire month of August. So if you look that page up, they're doing kayaking, fishing. They'll actually have an opportunity where you can go along with wildlife biologists and band ducks. So they bait them into a site and then set off a cannon net and capture them. And then banned them. That was actually one of the activities that got me interested in wildlife as a young child and started on this path. And also some information on beekeeping and some folks that participate in that activity, being able to talk a little bit about it and how to take care of the bees. So lots of opportunities at Crex Meadows throughout the month of August. And then I know we talked about bats, but for those of you that are familiar with the Bat Festival, it had been in Milwaukee for a number of years. It's actually moving north. It's going to be at the Great Lakes Visitor Center in Ashland on August 25th. For those that are interested in learning, well, they'll have live bats there, but also talk about some of the science and the issues with white nose syndrome and things that you can do to help bats, how to build bat houses. And I know that they're interested in getting more volunteers to help with some of their bat counts and survey work throughout the state.
And you might even see Judith Sears Poisson, our resident bat expert here at Wisconsin
Excellent.
Public Radio. She does a lot with citizen surveys and banding.
That's great.
She could really use some help.
Yeah. She's the bat lady here at Wisconsin
awesome.
Public Radio for sure. Well, I want to go back to the Urban Wildlife Workshop as well. Let's talk about that again. We brought it up right away in the beginning of the show, but tell people about what's all going on.
Yeah, so we are, Jamie and myself, are going to host an Urban Wildlife Workshop on Saturday, September 15th, and it is co-hosted with our Department of Forest Wildlife Ecology, UW Extension, the Urban Ecology Center in Milwaukee, and the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and Diane Robinson specifically, who's the biologist in Milwaukee County. So it will be on Saturday, September 15th from 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. at the Urban Ecology Center's Riverside Park location. And if you're interested, if you live in Milwaukee or you can get to Milwaukee, we can host up to 100 people during the workshop. And the whole idea is to help you create, enhance, and manage wildlife habitat in your yard for wildlife in that urban landscape. And you know, as we've talked about, there's a whole host of reasons you might want to do that. It increases your property values. It can improve your human health. It's good for the wildlife. And it can attract a whole host of wildlife species that are very good and will not necessarily cause a problem for you or pose any issues to you. So we'd love to have you come out and take part in that. It's $30 for registration fee. I think there's going to be some information up on your website, Larry, or the Facebook page. And also, if you go to the Urban Ecology Center, you should be able to find information there as well.
Yeah, go to that Urban Ecology Center because that's up already.
Yep.
And so I would highly recommend that for sure.
Good. Yep, absolutely.
And so maybe we have a quick question here from Carl in Potosi. Hi, Carl. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I had a question about bats also.
Yeah.
I was just curious. I live in Grant County, and we have a pretty low bat population where we live. And I just know that having not so many bats can affect the amount of mosquitoes we have in our area. I was just curious if we'd have any other adverse effects from having a low population.
Yeah, so that's a good question, Carl. So why should we be concerned about bat and the white nose syndrome and the decline in bat population? First and foremost is, you know, bats are a native species to Wisconsin. It's part of the biodiversity of our state. And so from that standpoint, it's important that we try to maintain as much of the biodiversity and the native species as we possibly can. You hit on the issue about insect control, mosquitoes in particular, and I forgot how many mosquitoes a single bat can eat. I think it's
600
like,
per hour.
Or it's like 5,000 a night or something like that. And you know, and the amount of pest control, insect pest control, natural pest control for protection of ag crops and things like that is just astronomical, and you know, hundreds of millions of dollars a year. Some bat species also will help pollinate, and so we've got a decline in pollinator species, bees in particular, and so anything to help with pollination is beneficial as well. So those would be some of the reasons we'd want to be interested in keeping bats around and make sure that we sustain the populations.
And on that note, we are about out of time. My goodness me, you guys are going to come back again and be with us in a couple of months, I hope.
We'd be happy to.
Yeah. You keep inviting us, we'll keep showing up.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that, and I bet our listeners are as well. David Drake, professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and a UW Extension wildlife specialist. Jamie Knack is a UW Extension senior wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. It's always great to have them along. And don't forget about that Urban Wildlife Workshop at the, it's coming up, when is it again?
Saturday, September 15th.
Saturday, September 15th. Tomorrow at this time, we'll take a look at consumer protection issues, and they'll be talking about fake warrant phone calls and other scams. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network.